Okay, welcome everyone. My name is Tim McGuile, one of the guiding teachers here at Seattle Insight, and we'll start with a 40-minute meditation. I'll just offer a couple words of guidance and then take a short break, have a chance to do a Dharma talk, and then some final questions and answers. Winter Poem by Nikki Govani. Once a snowflake fell on my brow, and I loved it so much, I kissed it, and it was happy, and called its cousins and brothers, and a web of snow engulfed me then. I reached to love them all, and I squeezed them, and it became a spring rain, and I stood perfectly still, and was a flower. All right, thank you for sharing the practice with all of us. All right, so we're continuing with our year-long exploration of the Four Noble Truths. So last month was focusing on the First Noble Truth, and this month the Second Noble Truth. So Steve Wilhelm gave a talk last week, and then next week we'll have Suze, and then we'll have Carrie Peterson, one of the other guiding teachers, offering a talk at the last week of February. So Second Noble Truth, there's also these 12 insights that go with that, each of these truths. And this one has the fourth insight, the origin of suffering, this craving or tanha. This craving should be abandoned, and then craving has been abandoned. So we have to like unpack this word craving and tanha a little bit, because our English language is going to lead us down some maybe some blind alleys as we start to go into it that way. I think first we should review this word called dukkha. What does this actually mean? Usually we translate that as suffering, but suffering itself misses some of the subtle qualities of just impermanence, or the fact that things are insubstantial, that things don't have a lasting quality to them. Anything in our lives, this building, for example, our bodies are in this process of constantly arising and passing away. That in itself is a nature of dukkha, right? In the last month, we talked about the different types of dukkha. And again, dukkha is this really, it's a nuanced word. There's different layers to it. There's different ways we can work with it. There's the ordinary dukkha of just having a human body. Physical bodies can experience pain, illness, sickness, injury, old age, death. There's also the dukkha around change, the fact that things are in flux, things are changing, and that we try to hold it to make it not change. There's dukkha that arises from that. There's also the dukkha of just this whole mental and emotional realm that we live in. Our fears, our hopes, our fantasies, all these things just kind of swirl around and create a level of dukkha also. Now, dukkha itself, it's interesting because it can be, in some ways, it's not a problem. It's really how we relate to it that makes it a problem. And that's when the Second Noble Truth starts to come in, right? Because we can have pain. We can feel physical pain. And there's a level of dukkha with that. There's a level of discomfort with that. But what we add to that, that's the second arrow, this added on reactivity, this added on meaning around it, the selfing, the blaming ourselves, blaming others. This amplifies that level of pain. I talked about this a few weeks ago around the optional nature of dukkha. There's also the dukkha that comes from change itself. You know, if we relate to change just as another thing that's just a natural process, there's no problem, right? There's no problem that things get older and our children leave and grow up. You know, and our bodies age and our parents die and then we die. There's a naturalness to it. Right? It's just how we relate to it is what causes this dukkha. So I'm trying to point to how there's these different layering of dukkha upon dukkha. There's a natural part of dukkha that's just the way things are. And there's another kind of dukkha that we really add to it. And that's really the realm of the Buddha's teaching. That's the realm of Dharma practice. So in some ways, it's the relationship we have to experience that activates dukkha or makes it be this maybe big letter dukkha, capital D. So it doesn't mean we have to experience dukkha when we experience ordinary suffering. And that's actually very hopeful. That's actually why if you see so many people who are deeply practiced, they have more of an equanimity. They have more of an ease as they go through life. The Buddha's followers, one prince was remarking that he could always tell who the Buddha's followers were because they seemed content. They seemed happy. They seemed at peace. While other practices were a little bit more upset and tight and heavy. So the word that the Buddha used for the second noble truth is this word tanha. Okay, tanha, sometimes we translate it as thirst, as hunger. And it's an important word. Sometimes we just translate it as craving. But craving, again, we have to kind of unpack that a little bit. Because when I hear that word craving, does that mean I'm not supposed to feel anything pleasurable? Am I not supposed to have anything I enjoy in my life? You know, is that kind of, to be Buddhist means I have to let go of all those things. And that's not the case. You can actually really enjoy life. You can enjoy the beauties of life. You can enjoy all the sense gates. The difference is when we start to go into this process of self-making and identification around that. So we're going to try to unpack that a little bit tonight as we explore this. Because we can actually set up as just as much suffering and tanha by trying to turn away from what's pleasurable, because we're doing it from a place of selfing, of ego. The Buddha spoke about three types of tanha. Okay, the tanha, or the thirst, the hunger. So the thirst for sense pleasure, the thirst for becoming, for existence, and the thirst for non-existence. So let's see if we can make some sense of that. So the first one, the thirst for sense pleasure, the tanha, kama tanha. This is a thirst that is, you know, this is, we can really connect with this experience when we really want something, you know, something pleasurable. Maybe it's a dessert. We want some kind of experience. We've really leaning into a music. There's an album that we really love. There's that quality of moving toward. So there's a part of it that's not dukkha, but it starts to shift when we become, you can notice when it's shifted, because when that, let's say you're really fantasizing, after the set, I'm going to go home and have that last piece of cake. And then you come home and realize someone else in the house ate it, right? All right, then that's the tanha coming up. That's when you switched into that quality of craving. Or, you know, we have this expectation of how things are or should be, and they're different than that. Now, tanha is an interesting one from this sense pleasure, because sometimes I like to play with it that way, like something like a cookie or a piece of cake, something that I really have a desire for. If I just sit with it and not act upon that desire, I get to experience what it actually feels like to want, the felt sense of leaning into. Right? So this overlaps with one of the hindrances of craving, of that movement or desire, that movement toward. But if you practice sitting with it and without acting from it, just, you know, even for a little bit, you get to feel it more intensely, that movement of really wanting something, really wanting that. And it feels like a physiological hunger. You can feel that deep. Of course, then it also shifts into all the memories and all the history. This is how we start to layer upon as human beings what that cake might represent. So it's tricky with this first one because we can misinterpret the teaching saying, okay, I should never want anything. If I want something, I should practice turning away. I should become very stoic and self-denying. Remember the Buddha's early years before he became the Buddha, he explored different pathways to try to reach enlightenment. And one of the pathways he explored was deep concentration states, deep jhana states, going to some of the highest levels. But he realized those states, even though they were so pleasurable and they felt so good, they themselves were impermanent. They themselves were dukkha. They themselves wouldn't last. And therefore, it wasn't what he was looking at. So then he thought, okay, I'm going to go the other direction. I'm going to go into what was kind of popular in that day and age was self-mortification. It would be starving the body, maybe standing in one position for a long time, an awkward position. And he kind of fell in with a gang of people that were really practicing that, really devoutly, really not eating very much, just meditating day in and day out, bringing a lot of willpower to bear. To the point he almost died from that. He was really close to dying. He was so emaciated, so on the brink of starvation. And then someone brought him a bowl of rice, which he ate, and he started to rebalance his system. And he realized, okay, I need to find this middle path that's not going into being lost in pleasure, but also not being lost in self-mortification. And we hear this first one about craving sense pleasure is one of the causes of suffering. It's easy to go down that pathway. Okay? But it's not that. It's not about not enjoying and appreciating the good things in life. It's when we start to become attached to it. And there starts to be this shifting into, to say simply, it's the selfing process, which we'll get into a little bit more here as we go through tonight. Now, starting to notice this sense of craving towards something that you really a sense pleasure starts to help you identify that quality of craving when it shows up more subtly, these last two elements. Because it's sometimes easy to overlook that craving to want to become, the craving to want to not become. But you can sense perhaps that it's actually a very similar feeling, that sense of wanting. So the next type of tanha is the bhavana tanha, the existence, thirst for existence and becoming. Okay, the thirst for existence and becoming. Now, it's hard to talk about the second noble truth without going into the dependent origination. This is this whole 12 cycle or 12 link state process that the Buddha mapped out, showing us how we go through this mechanism of creating a sense of self. It's actually it's a very profound thing to explore, and it's very important to explore. But these words like becoming, this word like craving or tanha, is actually part of those links. Just kind of quickly summarize that to kind of make sense of this is that we don't start in a neutral place when we walk into a room. You know, we walk into the room based on our past experiences. Our past experiences kind of prime us to interpret life in a certain way, right? So that interpretation is like the sense gates receive something. We hear a bell. If you've never meditated before, you may have some thoughts about it, but I guarantee if you've meditated a lot, that bell has a different significance based on your history, your way of practicing with it. Sometimes the bell is a very welcome sound when your body is uncomfortable. Sometimes it's a sound that, oh, I want to just keep practicing a little bit more. And sometimes it can just be a sound that's being heard, that's being noticed, right? So based on our history, we interpret life as it comes in. And that kind of this is there's all this background way that we meet life. This is part of our prejudices, part of our biases. These are our projections. This is the way we project our past history on the world. So it's like we're primed to interpret life that particular way. So then we have some sense data come in. This is the moment of contact. This is coming right into the present moment. So in that present moment contact, it's usually flavored in some way. It's flavored either as being slightly pleasant, slightly unpleasant, or neutral. Kind of in between, or neither pleasant or unpleasant. So things which are pleasant, we can just notice it at that level. Oh, that's a pleasant sound. That's a pleasant sensation, a pleasant smell. Or that's an unpleasant smell. No big deal. But what tends to happen is that we very quickly go from just that noticing of pleasantness into this relationship with it. We start to move toward it. We want more of it. We start to move away from it. We want less of it. Right? This is starting to go into what's called clinging and then into craving. Actually, I think it's craving and then clinging. So craving is just that little bit of movement. And then clinging, we start to become tighter around it. This leads to the next stage, which is becoming. It's trying to become really the sense of identity who forms around it. And that leads to what the Buddha called birth. And then there's this whole existence there. And then finally, what is born falls away, dies eventually. And then there's often suffering in relationship to that. Now, in this culture, when we talk about becoming, I mean, we can probably walk to a New Age bookstore and find lots of books on how to become, how to manifest, this is a good thing, right? We want to be more of. But the Buddha said that becoming actually ties us to suffering. And it's tricky because this is so much of what our lives we love to do. We like to become, we like to engage, we like to be in relationships, we like to experience new things, we like to have great ideas. Those are all positive types of becoming. Now that becoming, when those positive states end, there's suffering from that. It's like, oh, I'm no longer that new person, or the relationship ends, or that hobby falls away, or my body ages, and we experience suffering. But you may have noticed that you can't just only have positive becomings in your life. Anyone ever have any negative mind states, negative beliefs that come up? Anyone have, self-belief of self-diminishment that comes up? This is the other kind of becoming that we go into. So that we have the suffering while we're having that. Maybe when it ends, there's the relief of that. But the Buddha looked at that whole process and said, okay, that is this movement of tanha. That's that movement of thirst, the thirst to become, to kind of incarnate, if you will, into a sense of self. So this gets hard to talk about this without getting too subtle and deep. But basically, the sense of self seems like it's continuous and non-changing. It's like I'm just going through, right now I'm in a meditation hall or listening online on a Zoom meditation sangha. And then, maybe I'll go have dinner, go to sleep, and then I have my job and maybe relationships. But I'm kind of experiencing all of those. What the Buddha realized is if you look closely, there's actually many arisings in each of those moments. Even as we're sitting here listening, you may be listening, you may be liking what I'm saying, you may be not liking. Each of those create a different self that's arising with it. And another self's quickly arising after that. And it's like that connect the dot. You have all these dots and we just keep drawing the lines between them. And when we believe that that's true, when we relate to that, we're always going to experience some level of this optional dukkha, this optional suffering, because that self will fade. It will end. And there'll be a new self that comes up, but then it'll fade again. So there's kind of this constant back and forth. So this is a quick way of describing dependent origination and this whole second noble truth of tanha. So this thirst to become, you can start to sense into that. What does it feel like when you really want, maybe some of you are in school, some of you are working on some project, maybe you're trying to have a baby, maybe you're trying to retire, maybe you're trying to go into something out in front of you. You're trying to let that grow, right? That's that hunger to be, the hunger to become, right? Now just break that back into this present moment, and there's this Okay, I want to be a positive expression of myself. This is this bhavana tanha, thirst for existence and becoming. Now, the other side of it is the thirst to not be. And this is a little more tricky, but it's still the same kind of thirst. It's just going the opposite direction. And this is a thirst that we don't usually like to have. We don't usually like to feel bad about ourselves. We don't usually like to feel inadequate or a failure. Yeah, that's that hunger, but it's still, there's a hunger to be. Because reflect that when you're really feeling down or upset, is there any doubt about who and what you are in that moment? You know, there's a clarity that, okay, I'm this depressed person. I'm this anxious person. I really know who and what I am. Right? Same thing when I'm really excited by something, I really know who I am. So in some ways, the Buddha and the Dharma practice is giving us, in some ways, an identity crisis. If you start to hold this question, you know, what am I? Who am I really outside of this becoming? And this goes into next month when we open to the third noble truth, the cessation of tanha, sensation of dukkha. So this thirst to not become can be often be very powerful. It can be very, maybe we're more oriented that way, that okay, we get really triggered. And again, it's tricky because it's painful, and it's, why would I want to do this? Why would I want to engage in it in this way? And yet would rather be upset and still be established in who and what we are. So these three thirsts, these three tanhas, whether it's going towards something pleasurable, like a sense pleasure, and we form an identity around that, or maybe it's that pleasure of trying to become, or that hunger to become a new professional, be in a different relationship, or whatever it might be an athlete in a certain way. There's so many myriad ways that shows up. The hunger of being embarrassed, the hunger of not wanting to be here. All of these have the common denominator is this sense of me, this sense of I, this sense of self-perspective. So this is, again, this gets very deep, and it's harder to talk about if we haven't had a direct experience of it, because from the mind's perspective, it doesn't really make much sense. It seems like, why would I even do this? Why would I even try to practice in this way? But we start to practice in small ways in our lives. We start to loosen this power of tanha through the nature of meditation practice, through insight, through investigation, through the devotional elements of practice. All these start to take us outside of ourselves, outside of this limited self-perspective. And think about your own life, how you start to feel less triggered by things that used to be triggered by. That some things you're able to be a little bit more connected with. You don't have to be so, you don't find yourself being so reactive. It's not because you chose not to do that. It's because it just doesn't seem to rise in the same way. Has anyone noticed that as they've practiced? It's really encouraging to talk to others about that and to share that, because that's actually the Four Noble Truths starting to work on you. And it's almost like behind the scenes, you could practice without ever hearing about the Noble Truths, and you would start to find them arising in your experience. Because we're learning first how to make contact with this moment, to make contact with this body breathing, ears hearing. We start to be able to make contact with the various levels of suffering in our lives, physical pain, mental pain, emotional pain. We start to develop this capacity to open to it without flinching, without becoming so lost in it. And there's, of course, times we get washed off our feet, but those times become less and less. What's happening in that process is we're becoming less identified. We're actually developing this capacity to meet experience without going down this whole cycle of dependent origination. We're becoming less we're learning how to be completely connected and present and yet not having the self be so connected. And this is why, from the sense of self's perspective, this doesn't make much sense. Because if I'm not here doing this, it's like it just, there's nothing that's going to be here. It's like I'm going to just vanish, pop like a soap bubble or something. And yet, those of us have been practicing for a while, and I bet everyone in the room and on at home have had times of experience of this, perhaps very deep times of this. When you're able to be connected to life, connected to your experience, without having to make a lot of story around it, without having to have a lot of reaction around it. Sometimes it's something painful, sometimes it's something beautiful, sometimes it's just something very mundane and normal. In those times, tanha is not so present. There's not this thirst to move toward or away from experience. There's a simple abiding with it. Right? So by connecting with the present moment, connecting with what dukkha is, we're starting to naturally start to let go of tanha. It starts to fall away from us. You start to touch into this third noble truth, the cessation of dukkha. So how do we work with this? How do we start to practice with it? The homework I put out, so you have to just practice on your own this next week. But become interested and curious about this actual experience of thirst, of tanha or hunger, of desire, however you like to frame it, however you like to hold it. Start to relax the need to act upon that thirst and notice it in the body and emotions. So this is like mindfulness 101. This is, I'm doing an intro class right now, and this is what we're learning is how do we sit still even when the body's wanting to move and the mind wants to move. And it's a little bit like training, if you ever train like a puppy or something, they want to do what they want to do. Right? You have to be very patient to let them come back. Okay, this is what we're doing right now. This is what we're doing. Right? So that coming back, that's training us to be able to connect with the experience of tanha without having to follow it. Right? You have an itch. Right? So if I have an itch and I scratch it, you know, there's nothing wrong with, of course, I start to feel itches all over the place. But if there's nothing wrong with scratching it, but if I practice not scratching it and I feel the impulse to move with it and I'm able to sit with that for a while, it starts to loosen up that impulse, right? So that allows me to learn the technique or the methodology to apply other things other than an itch, right? That impulse to lash out, the impulse to write that angry email, the impulse to make a less than friendly gesture on the freeway. You start to feel the impulse, but you realize you don't have to act on it. And once you start to do that, something interesting happens internally. You start to feel this growing inner friendliness with your own experience. Because like a lot of us, before we start to really develop this with ourselves, it's like we're kind of keeping ourselves at guard. Okay, I can't open to that part of me because if I do, then it's going to get out of control. But once you realize I can open to it, doesn't mean I have to act from it. I can actually just be present with it. This is a beautiful thing to start to notice, that I don't have to keep acting from this. You don't have to act from those ways of kind of painful or destructive ways of interpersonally interacting, and also internally, I can start to be kinder to my own inner experience. And you can frame all of this as learning to not follow that thirst, that tanha. Okay, tanha is that impulse to act, impulse to do something with. Now, the important thing to talk about, too, is that that doesn't mean we're just become completely passive in our lives, that we don't ever act. It's actually we start to learn when our actions can flow from maybe a wiser place, a more compassionate place, a place of clarity, and when the actions are flowing from a place that's not so clear, that's flowing from a place of maybe reaction or inner hurt. And I can pause with that. I can pause with this. So relaxing with that act, that need to act, notice it in the body, noticing the sensations, emotions. The body is such a great refuge for you if it's accessible, because you can feel the tension, you can feel the contraction. And you can start to see this too, more subtly, how you want to be a certain person. You can often notice this when people maybe mildly disrespect you or don't understand you or overlook you. It's like, wait, I want to be seen in a certain way. You can feel that hunger to want to be perceived in a certain way. And that's that hunger to become. Or maybe that hunger to not be seen, not to be judged. And a deeper question to hold all around this is this: where is this sense of me who's having this experience? Who's a sense of me who's wanting to have this? Now, this is a way of taking, because once we're kind of in the middle of this cycle of dependent origination, it's almost like we've jumped on the Ferris wheel and it just keeps on going. If you've been on those, and you think you're about to get off, and okay, they're letting people off, but no, they just keep going, and you're, okay, now I'm going to get off, and it keeps going and going. Usually they get you off before you want to get off. But that when we're in that cycle of dependent origination, it's kind of the last ending of that, when that sense of becoming birthed into that self-identity, when that finally fades and ends and dies, that creates a level of suffering, a level of ignorance, which then leads into the next becoming. Right? So that's why it's kind of pretty tricky. But you can sometimes cut through that by asking a question. Okay, I'm stuck in this mind state. I'm really upset. It's like, okay, where is the person who's having this experience? Where's the person who's really upset? Can I actually locate that? Can I actually sense where it is? And you'll find if you actually practice this and try this, that it's fascinating, because if you don't ask the question, it's really obvious who and what you are. Yeah, of course I'm upset. How could you even ask that question? But you ask where is that sense of I who's having that upsetness? And you actually look for it, you can't really find it. Maybe you can find sensations, maybe you can find contractions or memories, but it's not as defined as it seems to be. If you look more and more closely, you're starting to see that that's actually very illusionary. And that's what the Buddha realized, is this sense of self is something that is arising and passing away. The more we invest in the sense of self, the more dukkha is going to arise with that. The less we do, the less suffering we'll experience. We see through it completely. This optional dukkha falls away. The third noble truth, the cessation of dukkha. So start to frame, you know, this normal, very human quality of wanting to be seen a certain way, wanting to be liked or disliked, whatever it might be. Start to see that as this process of tana. Start to notice that urge to want things and how your identification, your sense of happiness seems so dependent upon that extra cookie or whatever it might be. Realize, oh, I'm taking form here. And sometimes just drop that question. Who and what am I? Where am I located? Can I actually find it? Can I contact it? All right, let's just sit quietly for a couple moments, letting those words settle. All right, thank you for your kind attention. So I have a chance now for any questions or sharing you might have around this topic or other aspects of the Dharma. And here in the room, you can raise your hand and Cheryl will bring the mic over so they can hear you online. And online, you can just raise your virtual hand and I'll call on you and we can hear you.
Thanks for the talk.
You're welcome.
Can you talk a little bit? Am I there? Can you talk a little bit about how the kinds of reflection that we're doing that you're suggesting we do as homework that feel like they're really in the activity of the day, those things that I'm thinking about. If I have the urge to flip someone the bird in on the highway or whatever, you know, like, oh, I have awareness about that. Can you talk about how what we're doing actually in on the cushion relates to the practice in daily life?
Around this kind of inquiry question?
For example.
Yeah, for example.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's... So depending on how we're meditating, you know, again, mindfulness meditation is a big umbrella. We're learning how to, you know, connect it with the present moment, connecting with this felt sense of the breath or the body sensations, releasing story and thought, coming back again and again. That's very, one thing that's developing is that level of concentration, of that steadiness. You're also starting to learn the difference between our thoughts and concepts of something versus the direct experience of it. And ideally, you know, when we're connecting, we're sometimes our meditation can be very specific and narrow in its focus, sometimes much broader. But whichever, you know, spectrum we're working on, working with in our practice, it's giving us this understanding of what it means to really connect in this present moment, right? And knowing, again, our story versus the direct connection. So you go into your daily life and you feel this impulse to act. You know, before we start to practice, we didn't have much connection with our inner experience. We just start to lash out. But I can start to feel that it basically slows down the process of reactivity. We become, you know, not like awkwardly slow, but it's just there's a little bit of space between the initial pinprick of pain and the reaction. We feel the pinprick of pain. We're able to open to it, hold it, feel it, sense it. And sensing in the body, sensing in the mind state that arises around it, sensing the emotions that arise around it, all this is very helpful. And the meditation practice can cultivate that. You can be sitting and, you know, someone's making a noise which you don't like. You can, you know, argue with the fact or try to change it, or you can work with your own reaction, right? So it's a way of kind of a controlled way of practicing opening to the present moment. And as you do that, you know, a lot of the practices of meditation are kind of opposite of what the sense of self usually does, right? Usually, you know, we look at something and we look at someone, we're liking them, we're disliking them, we're judging them, comparing them. And in meditation, we're just, you know, we're feeling the breath. It's how different can the breath be? But we're learning how to meet each breath very freshly, very innocently, and we're learning how to kind of peel back those layers. So that's really opposite of what the sense of self does. So the sense of self is starting to become thinner, a little softer just through practicing. The body outline becomes less defined. The sense of you becomes less defined. We're really open to the felt sense of breath, body, felt the direct sense of hearing. Let go of the label of the sound to the actual experience. So all those things allow us to take something that feels very personally and emotionally charged, and realize, we start to see how maybe it's there's more space around it. We can say, okay, it's not as solidly me as I thought it was. It allows us to be more, have a greater perspective. And, you know, in daily life, asking like that question of, you have to have that discernment too, right? Because if you're driving on the freeway, you can't just, okay, everyone stop for a second. I want to spend about 10 minutes meditating here. You know, you have to still be, you know, controlling the vehicle. I think a very helpful time to do this is when you actually are kind of stuck, when you're like just finding yourself cycling through this rumination and this irritation with the situation. That's a beautiful time to just, okay, then what does it feel like as a body experience? Where's that sense of me who's so upset? Oh, wait. It seemed like it was there a second ago. As I look, I don't see it. Yeah, so you can, you know, find ways of kind of debriefing, if you will, or a situation, and that allows you in the moment to be much more, in the future you can be more kind of quick to do it. Does that kind of get to your question? Yeah, it's an important question. We could probably spend a whole year on that. All right, Leslie. And then we'll go to Debbie in a second.
So I'm challenged by the third of the three.
Okay.
Thirst. I don't quite understand craving to not be.
Yes.
Don't understand that.
Yeah, it's tricky because it doesn't, I mean, why would you want, is that like, why would you thirst after that?
Yeah,
why
would you want to die?
Yeah.
I mean, kind of.
Well, here's the alternative. If you're not thirsting to become to become, and I guess that's often like that sense of you know, shyness or that sense of self-hatred, all those qualities, compare that to being, from the ego's perspective, being completely absent. The ego would much rather have a negative sense of self. It's much rather be, you know, in the spiral of self-deprecation and self-hatred than being gone.
I don't, okay, so the thirst for becoming, I completely understand.
Yes.
And what you're saying is that it's like the thirst of, rather than going, rather than just not having a self or not having that sense, you get attached to depression or your self-hatred. Is that?
It's kind of that way, but look at the sense of that, the hunger to become, right? So that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the hunger to become, it's often a positive state, right? I want to look how good I am. Kind of a thing,
yeah.
Right? This kind of the hidden, you know, hunger is just that, the way it defines who and what you are.
Right.
You know, if I ask you, who are you when you're feeling really good about yourself, you could define yourself in a certain way. I'm really good at this and I'm really good at that and, you know, all this stuff. But there's this way that it really establishes who and what you are.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, when that role or situation changes, there's suffering with that. There's pain with that. It's like, oh, I've lost that. So there's the pain of just being attached to it, but there's also you becoming less defined. So it's tricky because it's a hard sell because our normal conventional way of relating to the world is really based upon this sense of self. That's the fundamental assumption. And yet the practice points to there's this whole other way of being in the world that's not of that sense of self.
Right.
Right. So that kind of hunger to not be, that kind of self-annihilation, that deep depression, that self-hatred forms that sense of you.
Right. It still has more. I get it. Okay. Yeah.
Does that help a little bit?
Yeah. I got it. Yeah.
Okay, good. All right. So Debbie, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. So I'm thinking about like the tanha of becoming, and I'm thinking about like, you know, like your sense of self gets caught up in like your accomplishments or like your ability to do something. And I'm wondering like what the balance is when like you have to perform well at work. And if you don't, like there's consequences to that, right? So you're attached to performing well, maybe attached isn't the right word, but like you have to perform well because there are consequences if you don't,
sure.
You know what I mean? Like, and I guess I'm just like, I understand the like, you know, chilling in your car instead of flipping somebody off. But like, I'm trying to take it into like, situations where there are consequences for things, you know, like, I don't know. Could you speak to that? Does that make enough sense to?
Yeah, it does make sense. Yeah. And this is an important, you know, element to explore because, you know, here's a way I think it's really helpful to think about it. There's the navigational self and then there's kind of that absolute self, right? So the navigational self knows how to do the job really well. You know, knows how to navigate the world. And it's like we're kind of really inhabiting that role or that perspective. I mean, if I'm having surgery, I want my surgeon to be not like yeah, it doesn't matter, you know, if he bleeds out, it's okay. You know, everything's empty after all. You know, I want them to bring all their knowledge to bear, right? So this is what's interesting, and it's a paradox, but I think, you know, many of us have started to get a sense of that you can be, you know, fully engaged in something, but inwardly you're not taking it personally. You're not identified with it. In some ways you could say that actually enhances your ability to do your job well. Because when you're like, okay, I really want to do well, sometimes that makes you not do things well, right? You know, you start, like I remember, you know, cross-country skiing and going down the hill and saying, okay, I don't want to fall, almost guarantees I'm going to fall. But if I'm able to kind of like let that thought go and just be in the moment of experience, I'm able to kind of navigate that, you know, that slope. And so it's similar to other things in our lives. It actually allows us to be much more fluid, because sometimes in any job that we have, there's different ways we have to show up to it, right? Sometimes we have to be really proactive and clear and assertive. Other times we have to be more receptive and more listening and more giving. But if we're just kind of caught in one mode, we're not able to be so responsive. So it seems like it's a paradox, but it's not a paradox. It allows us to really, in some ways, optimize the capacity to be fully into life, into whatever role we have. And you can tell, like, okay, but it's that little voice that goes, if I screw up, then that means I'm this kind of, that's what it means about me. Okay, that's that pain of self. That's an added on suffering. That's that self-identification around it. And that you can actually really open to and work with. And it will, I could probably guarantee, you might find some kind of role that doesn't work for, but it kind of purifies it, you know, so you're able to be very engaged, and yet, you know, it's like you can let go of it.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Debbie. All right, anyone else? Yeah, Beth, and then we'll go to Charles here.
As you were talking, I was thinking about that, the Zen, who is this? Who wants to flip the bird? Who is this? Who's feeling this? And that what is this? And sort of stops in the tracks. And the other thing I was thinking, I don't know if anybody's reading, I'm assuming you mentioned Philip Moffitt's book, Dancing with Life.
Yes.
And he speaks of Ajahn Sumedho's wanting to flip off the driver feels like this. It feels like this. This is what it's like. And going back to the body, as you were talking about, the sort of just trying to stop the movement, the momentum.
That's right.
Even when, like, well, it is like training a dog, actually. You know, like there's no big philosophy. It's just like literally stopping the mind. There's something about asking those questions that stops the mind from whatever it's doing. It might pick it up and do it again, but anyway.
Yeah, it's like this is what it feels like to want to flip the bird, to use your words. What that's doing is you're stepping back into this place of witnessing, this place of mindfulness to observe your experience. In that sense of observation, you suddenly have a lot of choice in it. It's this really interesting journey we go on, because if we start practice, and Zen, you mentioned Zen, often has these Zen stories have this kind of story arc. That as a beginner, we're just completely in the middle of our experience. We're just, you know, doing these gestures and acting in reaction. And then we start to practice and we start to observe that. And then we start to kind of develop this training around it, and maybe don't act on it. We're just observing it. And then as our practice finally matures and deepens, we come back into life kind of in a much more spontaneous way, but yet it's completely transformed by that. Was there anything else about that, Beth? Just what kind of observing or sharing about that?
And I was just what you were saying kind of sparked those memories about
yes.
ways that just stops the problem and what people were sharing. I guess it was just a share.
Yes, thank you.
An interjection.
Yep, you're right on.
And I recommend Dancing with Life. I've read it 4 times.
All right, Dancing with Life by Philip Moffitt. All right, you still want to share something? Yep, up here in front. Thanks, Cheryl.
Hi, I wanted to ask, I feel like sometimes it can be possible to get addicted to a negative kind of becoming.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like especially the craving to not become, if you get addicted to that, you can get addicted to wallowing in self-pity, mm-hmm. in avoiding discomfort, instead of trying to draw pleasure from the craving of becoming, where you have these great goals, and although they might be uncomfortable, you strive for them anyway. You get addicted to the pleasure of not becoming, and you don't pursue anything difficult, and you instead wallow in your slow demise. Hmm. I feel like that's what I've seen in myself. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, like, does that make sense? And how do you get out of that?
Yes, those are all really important questions, and yeah, it does make complete sense. And I think it's also, the nice thing about this day and age is that we don't have to just use one set of tools. That sometimes the Dharma, you know, has so much depth and clarity, and sometimes there are other tools which actually fit a little bit better. So like when we get really in that sense of spiraling down and that it just kind of has a life of its own. It just kind of, it's almost like the whole world is kind of taking on that perspective. We can look at it from a dharmic perspective, but sometimes it's actually helpful to do more of like the Western, you know, therapy, psychological work to actually look at, because what that does is starts to take, because we're kind of in this whole cycle of self-identification, which is painful and, you know, maybe self-destructive and it just feels, it's, you know, it just, there's a lot of assumptions and beliefs which are really in that. We can map that with dependent origination, but I think sometimes it's helpful to say, let's kind of forget about that for a little bit. Let's look at it from like a psychological perspective. Let's see how those beliefs form. And that was really critical for my own practice, is to actually flush that stuff out, to see it more clearly, to see kind of the deeper beliefs that were there. And by doing it from that perspective, then the Dharma actually was able to work much better. Because it's tricky is if we start to look at it from, because it kind of takes on the shape or the way we perceive from that. We try to look at it from a Dharmic perspective, we don't realize we're kind of already, we've already seen it from, we're like, we've already got glasses on. That's really coloring, distorting things. So you have to be able to see that distortion in itself. And I think sometimes Dharma practice in itself, we need a different way of approaching it. And, you know, good therapy is a great way to do that. All right. Anyone else like to ask or share anything?
I think about, when I think about this idea of sort of becoming, I think that, or at least I do this, I tell myself stories, right? That, you know, I will feel good if I am with this person or I get this achievement.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you could sort of talk about how to relate to looking into the future and maybe like also sort of this idea of hope, right?
Mm-hmm.
To hope for something in the future and what role that sort of plays in this discussion.
Yeah, it's a really... important part of it, because sometimes we can hear these teachings and think there's no role for that, no space for that, because that's just going to be causing suffering at some point. And my teacher always, he would always say that if you really felt like you wanted to do something, it's good to just to follow that, you know, and let sometimes just putting your heart into it to really, whether it's, you know, attaining some, you know, skill or some degree or whatever it might be, to kind of let yourself follow that. Because if you deny it and you try to use the Dharma to make, talk yourself out of it, it's still there, right? And then after a while, our wisdom starts to see, oh yeah, that thing I really wanted, I could see how some of that was really nourishing and helpful and positive. And some of it was really tied to this sense of self. Because that sense of self starts to fall away, some of our inner motivation falls away too. Because it's like, look how great I am. It's like, well, I don't really identify with that me anymore in that same way. But we don't have to like jump to that. Just allow, you know, if you find something that you're really impassioned about, something you want to work toward or move toward in the future, there's nothing wrong with going into that. You know, just being as conscious as you can with it, being present with it. Because, I mean, look at, if the Buddha didn't have that, we wouldn't be sitting here talking about the Dharma, right? I mean, he had a passion for sharing it, for articulating it. You know, his followers had enough passion to be able to kind of make it into a system that we could actually transmit and talk about. So it's, you know, I think if we try to get kind of too hung up on that, and the Eightfold Path, that's the last noble truth, and that's the path leading to the end of dukkha. And the middle section is around, you know, around action, wise livelihood, wise speech, you know, wise action, right? So the good thing about livelihood, it's basically if you're not actively causing harm, you know, like if you're not butchering animals or weapons and things like that, you know, he said that's okay. So sometimes they're like, oh, I'm trying to sell people things that they don't want or don't need. We can get too caught up in that. You know, try to bring back forth that sense of what brought you forth, what made you alive, interested in that in the first place. Yeah, does that help at all? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Romilly up here in front. Thanks, Cheryl. Getting your exercise today.
I wanted to follow up on a question that he mm-hmm. had about not becoming.
Yes.
I wanted you to clarify your answer about the role of therapy.
Uh-huh.
And the role of like the dharmic path, or
yes.
Like, is there a conflict there? Or I don't think you said there was one, but yeah, can you just clarify?
Sure, yeah, the role of therapy versus dharmic path, is there a conflict? Are they complementary?
Yeah.
Probably the simplest way to sum it up is that we need to have a healthy sense of self. It's almost like we need to have that. It needs to be healthy enough first, and then we can start to notice the emptiness of that, the nature of self. Because if you don't have that healthy sense of self, that's going to tend to distort the very way that we're meditating, the way we're practicing. And it's going to tend to be this kind of gravitational field that's going to tend to pull us back in. We might have deep meditative states or deep, you know, even in awakening moments, but then relationships and life will tend to pull us back if we haven't really, if we try to skip over some of those deeper pains. Now we can stay maybe too long in therapy when it just kind of becomes this constant back and forth. You know, we're kind of at the level of just on the self, just trying to make the self better and better and better. Mm-hmm. It's like when the self is like, okay, there's the charges are kind of lessened enough. There's like, I'm not distorting my view of things. I'm not projecting my parents upon people or my brothers or my sisters or my siblings on people. There's just a way of being much more be present, be able to own my own experience. That's probably enough, you know, for most, right? You know, that's a lot actually, right? But we can stay a long time in that. And that's why the Dharma practice starts to say, okay, this sense of self, there's a way that it can start to fall away. I can remember my own practice and my own therapy work. There's a lot of really deep emotional work I was doing, and I started to meditate the same time. So I would get into those very deep places of pain, but then I could also start to hold it from a place of meditation, a place of spaciousness, of emptiness around it. And that seemed to make a big difference. So I wasn't forming a new conclusion about who and what I was. It was much more releasing the pain of self-belief. Does that make sense at all?
Yes, it does.
Okay,
thank you.
Good. Yeah. All right, thanks, Romilly. All right, anyone else have anything you'd like to ask or share? Yes.
So kind of building on that, the desire to not be, so you're talking about how you can run in therapy kind of in parallel to mindfulness and learning to lessen the self while at the same time kind of healing your sense of self.
Yes.
Can you speak a little bit more to discerning between when you're feeling like self-piteous or depression or anxiety or something like that? Can you speak to kind of discerning what's more like the first arrow and what aspect of that part of yourself is like kind of the mental illness coming in, and how much of that is like the second arrow of you not wanting to feel that way?
Yeah, it's tricky because, you know, with the one arrow, the second arrow, I mean, that's like a simple example, right? This is much more complex when we start to have like a, because like a depressive state or that anxious state, whatever, you know, something that has that very kind of all-encompassing, it does start to change the very way we're perceiving, right? So there's a part of us that just doesn't like that. And part of it is the wisdom is like, this doesn't feel good to be in this state of mind. So how much of that's discernment? How much of it is second arrow? You know, it's tricky because, you know, how do you work your way through that? How do you open to it? Because sometimes, you know, depression is, you know, needs to be, there's so many different ways of treating it. You know, sometimes it's really acknowledging some pain that hasn't been felt or some anger that hasn't been felt. Sometimes it's rebalancing the brain chemistry. There's all these different ways. And in a lot of therapies these days, they're bringing mindfulness right into it because it's so effective. You know, because you can have that felt sense of this experience. That's what starts to transform things. So in terms of, yeah, what's the second era? I probably wouldn't overlay that too much. You know, I think in retrospect, you'd be able to see that more clearly. You know, it's like, oh yeah, but a lot of it is just like the whole system is kind of perceiving through that. And you need to have some way of like, hey, there's another way of looking. There's another, you know, having, you know, someone who can actually connect with you and help you navigate that.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, Deanna and Bob, or Boo? Bo, sorry.
It's Bo. Bo. And it's just Bo. Deanna's not on camera. Hi, thank you for the talk. And so as I've been practicing with both the first and second noble truth, you know, I'm noticing lots of places in my life where suffering arises and starting to be able to see better, you know, that, you know, the pain and then the suffering, you know, what I add to the suffering and, you know, the often hear it described as the second arrow. And then what I, especially working with craving this month, I'm noticing that then I sort of start to judge myself for feeling that mm-hmm. second arrow. And it's like, almost feels like now there's a third arrow. So I'm wondering if you have any advice for kind of how to relate to that, you know, the kind of, as I notice that I'm bringing, you know, that the relationship that I'm having with this experience is what's causing suffering, how to kind of relate to that next level of judgment that's coming up around that.
Yeah, such an important question, because sometimes our practice gives us whole new ways to judge ourselves, right? It's like, oh yeah, now I didn't realize I wasn't supposed to have craving anymore. And then, oh, I should have judged the fact I'm having craving. So then I'm judging the fact that I'm judging. And we start to get tighter and tighter around it. So it's almost, but the good news is that it's actually just this kind of habit of mind of judgment, that we just find something, we use judgment as a placeholder for all that, if that's okay. So I'm judging my judgment, and I judge the fact that I'm judging. But it's just, it's basically the process of the mind seeing something which is, it's perceiving as being insufficient, not the way it wants it to be. And so what we do is we call forth a different quality of relating to it. So this is tricky because it has such a strong momentum and we're in the middle of it. But this is actually really pertinent to what we're talking about, because that's where we're caught in this cycle of tanha, of becoming around it. So step back, have something that comes back, steps back to observe, that's able to be okay with the fact that I'm judging the fact that I'm judging, right? And maybe it's a few more back. It's okay that I'm judging the judging of judging of judging. It's just a little bit, just a little bit of space around it. And one trick that I think is helpful around it is, because a lot of these patterns, it's almost like a flame that the moth is being drawn to. It just can't escape. It just has such a strong pull. Is to call your attention to something outside of that pattern to kind of reestablish the mindfulness. Like, I've done this a few times, but, you know, like, let's say this clock represents the thing I'm judging. And this represents something that's completely outside of that. It might be something external, like the sound of a bird, or might be the beauty of an evergreen tree or something like that. So I'll let that be known equally to this. That helps me recall that capacity to be a little bit more spacious around it. And unless we do that, we're kind of like, all we see is the clock or the painful piece there. So finding something else to kind of counterbalance your attention and try to hold yourself, I want to feel both equally, with a sense of balance from one to another. Then you can start to soften that whole part. And you can sometimes bring, you know, a phrase into it, like, okay, just like Beth was saying, like, okay, this is what this feels like. Or offering a phrase of metta toward this. Or my favorite way is to actually bow toward that pattern. Just say, thank you for how good of a job you are at judging. You're really good at that. That you've really practiced that. I can tell that you're a PhD in judging. You know, you're a world champion, Olympic champion in that. And that kind of sincere bowing changes it from being an adversive relationship to it to one of actually relating to it. All right.
Thank you.
It's an important question. Thank you, Bob, or Bo. All right, so we've come to the end of our time together. So I'd like to thank you all for your questions and your engagement, and thank you for joining us tonight, for those who are new tonight. And hope to see you next time. All right, thank you all.